Okay, this is sound roll number 70 for Fight in the Fields of Paradigm Production. We have a minus 8 dB reference tone to follow on the modulometer, which equals 0 VU. We're recording on a Nagra 4S XS timecode Harvey mod, and here comes tone. Okay, it's now the 23rd of April. We're in the office of Dr. Marian Moses. We're about to do the interview with her. We'll be starting with camera 148, and we'll be doing starting with take number one. Here we go.
Okay.
Rolling. This is take one. Marker.
Dr. Moses, you knew Caesar for many, many years. When you first met him, what was it that struck you about him?
Well, I don't know, because I heard him speak before I actually met him. And actually meeting him, I was never actually in a room sitting down talking to him until after I'd worked for the farm workers for almost 3 or 4 months. But what was my first impression of him when I heard him speak over at the Unitarian Church over in Berkeley? That was in October of 1965. It was almost 3 weeks after the strike, the grape strike, had started. And he was asking for really simple things. I mean, he wanted food, clothes, money if people had it. And he just wanted to give the message. And I guess what I've said many times, he wasn't really a good speaker. He wasn't a good speaker at all. But there was something about him, and I always say that the word charisma, which is often used, it doesn't even begin to describe whatever it is about him, whatever that was. And that's what I carried away from that first meeting. And when I actually did have a first meeting with him, I was pretty frightened of him, if you will. I mean, I was kind of scared because, I mean, this was Caesar, and I just thought, I didn't even know what I was doing in his office. I thought he was going to fire me or something because I'd done something. You're a volunteer. I'm worrying about losing my job. But basically, he just wanted to, he had known about the work that I was doing, and he was very appreciative, and he had a special job he wanted me to do. And I still remember that beautiful smile, and when he still had the gold tooth. I think it was on, the gold tooth. And I don't know when he got rid of that gold tooth. But that's what I remember. I remember him being not a terribly good speaker, a powerful presence, a beautiful smile, and a way of being very inclusive or in tune. And no matter how many people were around him, he was always looking at or speaking to or relating to the person that was right next to him.
Now, you also were close to him as a person, but also as a physician, and you were with him during the fast. I mean, what were your concerns when he was fasting? Were you concerned about his health?
Well, the first couple of fasts, I was a nurse, and I really didn't know as much, so I wasn't as concerned early on because I didn't know as much about the human body and what fasting could do to it. Plus, the fact that early on he really didn't fast that long. The fast that really concerned me was the last public fast, which was in August of 1988, which, as you know, went for 36 days.
I'm going to ask you a question again because I just heard a buzz.
Oh. Was that my buzz? Is that something I did?
No. All of a sudden, immunity.
Oh. Well, yeah, this is
a real important question.
Yeah.
Here, so.
Well, this is a noisy corner.
Yeah.
Can I ask you to rotate your chair more?
Okay, that was take one. Now comes take two.
This is take two.
Now, we were talking a bit ago about the 1988 fast. What did you observe in the 88 fast?
Well, it wasn't a matter of observing anything. It was a matter of being with Caesar during that fast. I got a call when he was starting on the fast from his son, Paul. And I did speak to Caesar. He was already fasting at that time. And I knew that it was going to be a long time. And so I just said, well, let me. He said, I'll let you know when I want you to come. Well, I got a call. He was only 12 days into the fast. And I got a call, I think it was from Artie, and they were very worried. And so I got in my car and I drove down to Delano because he was at the Agbayani village is where he was fasting. And I'll never forget when they took me to his room and the door opened, he's in his bed and he looks at me and he says, "What are you doing here?" I said, "That's what I want to know. What am I doing here?" Well, people get very worried and very scared and they think Caesar's dying and they're very scared. Well, you know, I wasn't really scared. I said, "Look, if you die, it's not my fault. I'm not the one starving myself to death." But I never worried about that because, you know, Caesar knew a lot about fasting. He'd done it before. It isn't like, and this was a very spiritual thing with him as well. And so it was always kind of good for him or better for him. And I knew that it was good for him, you know, psychologically, spiritually, maybe not physiologically, it wasn't so terrific. And so my job really was to work with him, and that's why he wanted me there. He knew that, you know, if he was really having trouble, if things were really not going well, that I would be very frank and honest with him, but I was going to treat him, not myself. I wouldn't treat my own fears and anxieties, which is the biggest problem he had with doctors. And that's why he liked me so much. Or I wouldn't say liked me so much. I think that's why we had a good, trusting relationship. The way I knew it was going to be a long fast, I remember when I was there, Dolores Huerta's son, Fidel, is also a physician. He was doing his residency at the Kern County Medical Center. So fortunately, he was able to come in and see Caesar pretty much every day. So we worked out a plan about drawing his blood so we could know what his blood chemicals, they're called electrolytes. It's very important to keep those in balance. And we had to, the only thing we would give him, he would have to have some, like baking soda. That's because his body was very acid. But that's really all. We would put that into the water, but he didn't really get any nourishment. It was just a matter of keeping his blood chemicals in balance. And I knew the best way to find out what they were is to draw his blood. Caesar hates to get his blood drawn. I mean, he creates the most royal, colossal fuss every time you want to stick him. And so, you know, I approached him. I said, "Caesar, you know, I'm going to be going back to San Francisco. Fidel, you know, we'll be keeping this up. But we really need to find out what your how your blood is doing. How often can we draw your blood?" And he said, "Mariana, as often as you want." And I thought, oh boy, we're in for a big one. He's never that compliant. He's never that. And I knew then it was going to be a very long fast.
Now, Richard had mentioned, he says, you know, things were okay, but once you go over 25 days, then we started to get nervous.
Well, no, I didn't really get nervous until I wanted him to quit one day earlier. Well, the biggest reason was a very dear friend of mine was getting married up in Sacramento, and I wanted to go to the wedding. And I remember I told her, I'll definitely be at your wedding. There's no way Caesar is going to go until Sunday. I'm sure Saturday is going to be his last day. Well, Sunday was his last day. It's different with different people. I mean, there's no such thing as saying, how long can you fast? Well, a lot of it depends on what your kidney function is like. A lot of it depends on how you feel about it. Physiologically, any fast is damaging to the body in the sense that it's not a natural state of the body. I would say he went, as far as I'm concerned, from a physician's point of view, I wish he had ended it one day sooner.
Okay. Now, there's been speculation about what caused Caesar's death. And
yes.
People say fasting, took a toll on his heart. What do you say?
Well, I don't know. I wasn't with Caesar the week before his death, but I did talk to people who were with him the week before his death, and he was not eating well. Let's just put it that way. And he may have been fasting. Now, whether or not that contributed, and it may well have done, I don't think any of us will ever know. But one thing I do know that it was a natural death. The family asked me to speak with the coroner, and I did. And I have the autopsy report, and it was a natural death.
Okay. We're going to change gears here now. you're a specialist in pesticides.
Well, my specialty is occupational medicine,
right.
Public health.
But can you just briefly say, you know, to tell us, you know, what were farm workers over the years, over the last 30, 40 years, what have they been up against in the fields?
Well, it's probably, I always say the toxic burden is there along with other, all of the other difficulties and the other working conditions that are, as we know, very, very bad for farm workers, the exploitation. I see the toxic burden, I see pesticides as an additional toxic burden to the harshness of their living and working conditions. And I remember when I first met Caesar in 1960, well, I met him in 65, but when I first started working with the union in 1966, he asked me if I knew anything about pesticides. Of course, I knew nothing about pesticides. And people also ask me, when did you get interested in pesticides? And I said, I never got interested in pesticides. I got interested in farm workers, and it was a problem that they had. Now, at the time that I started working with farm workers, I was a nurse, as I told you. That was before I went to medical school. I didn't know that much about them. And there were two sources of information that I used. One was Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, which had been published in 1962. And a lot of the people were still alive. So I got in touch with a lot of the people in the book. And the other is, there was a very good, the University of California at Berkeley had a very strong program in what's called biological control. In other words, non-chemical, non-toxics. And I met a lot of the professors there. So then I sort of started reading about, I knew what problems were, what to look for. But at that time, this was before there was any regulation and nobody really cared. And at that time, what came to my attention were things like serious poisonings. I noticed a big increase, a problem with asthma in children that I soon learned was definitely related to spraying season. So it was kind of a gross kind of a thing. And there really, the laws were even weaker than they are now. There was no way that we could find out what was being used. If they didn't want to tell you, they didn't tell you. So I might have had suspicions that some of these, even deaths, might have been related to pesticides. But at that time, it was impossible to do anything about it.
Okay, let's change here. What I'd like to do is now go bring us up to the present.
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 148. We're going to 149. Our next take will be take number 3.
Okay, this is take 3.
Now, in the 80s, you came back as a physician.
Yes.
And the union focused on pesticides issues in the 80s. What was going on there?
Well, I would say the union focused. They had always kind of had a great interest in it. It had always been a very important part of one of the protections that they wanted to, along with wages and working conditions and all the others, their exposure to toxic substances. But what changed was I was much more knowledgeable. I remember when I first came back in 83, Caesar wanted me to go on the Radio Campesina, the radio station for the farm workers, right away and talk about pesticides. But I wanted time to find out what had changed in terms of the pesticides they were using. Also, I wanted to build up some kind of a system that we would be able to handle any phone calls or any problems that might come in. Well, we didn't have the luxury of waiting because I hadn't been there more than a month when the cancer cluster in McFarland, which is a small town about 7 miles south of Delano, the first information came out about children in this small agricultural town that had a higher than expected rate of cancer, and this was among children. So that was in 1984 that first came to our attention. And then Caesar and the leadership of the union had always been very interested in pesticides. And basically what happened is, I think it was July of 84. I know it was 84. I'm not quite sure of the month, but I think it was July. They launched a specific focus on pesticides. I remember Caesar asked me, what are they, it was on grapes. At that time, there was a boycott against grapes, table grapes. And I had gone to the the different counties to Larry Kern to find out what was being used. And there were over 150 different pesticides being used. Well, we couldn't ban them all. So basically, Caesar wanted to look at things that posed a problem to consumers only, that left residues. I told him I thought we should look three ways, and that's kind of the way the thing focused. We should look at impacts or adverse effects on workers, consumers, and the environment. And basically, we picked the five. He asked me to pick the five worst chemicals on that basis. And as you know, we did pick five. That became incorporated into the union's strategies. And the interesting thing is, when we had the press conference in Los Angeles, it was the first reaction to the union, or actually where the growers came to the meetings and their representatives, and it showed how volatile and important an issue this was.
Okay. Now, people are talking about a rebirth of the union.
You know, before we go off that subject, if I may, it turned out one of the things that we tried to do in 1984 in terms of the health department's response to this, which was abysmal, was to do something about known cancer-causing pesticides. And at that time, roughly about 40 or 50% of the pesticides being used on grapes were known or suspect cancer-causing chemicals. And I said, if we don't do something about this, we're going to be looking at another McFarland. And then in 1989, in early March, indeed there was another cancer cluster was found. And this came from the workers themselves, because workers had been coming to Caesar and to the union. I was here in San Francisco. I had left the union by then. But I was asked to speak to these workers, and they said they had seven of them that had cancer. And they were all children of farm workers, and it turned out that six of them were. One of them was a hemophilia. It was a bleeding disorder. But all the others were cancers. And I think the important part of that, and the important part of Caesar's work in terms of pesticides, was to focus. We do care that it's killing people. We know that. We don't want people to die. In fact, there was a death recently. But Caesar focused on the important thing is what the long-term effects are. Because what everybody else says, well, as long as, you know, we're not having a funeral or they're not in the emergency room, it's not a problem. But Caesar realized it was this, particularly the exposures to women and to children, and a lot of pregnant women work in the fields. We know that these pesticides go through the skin, pass through the placenta, it can affect the developing child.
What about the consumer?
Well, the consumer, it's important. It's very important because the residues of these pesticides can be on the crops that are sold. But if you look at where the high exposure is and who is most at risk, it's clearly the worker. And one of the things that I always used to say, and I used to love hear Caesar saying it too, was if you protect the worker in the workplace, I guarantee you'll protect the consumer in the marketplace.
Okay, we're going to switch gears. We're going to get into this rebirth of the union. I mean,
yes.
You hear rebirth of the union. Do you see this as a rebirth of the union, not these new contracts, not the stuff?
Well, I never see it as a rebirth because, I mean, it's like saying maybe if we had a good presidential candidate, there might be a rebirth of democracy in this country. I don't think it's a rebirth. It's being very, very true to what the union is or was according to the way Caesar founded it. And the beauty of it is it was always, always worker-based. It was always a very honest union, and that's still true. So I don't really think it's kind of a rebirth. The union has always been there. It has always worked. People are starting to notice it again. Maybe there are more things happening that are, quote, newsworthy. But as you know, being in the news, in the reporting, or whatever, at least you're in the media business, that the media can be very fickle. And just because people are not covering what's going on, or you can't get somebody's attention, doesn't mean the union isn't strong and growing and continuing. So I don't see it as a rebirth. I see it more as a re-recognition of more notice being paid, attention being paid again to, I think, one of the most vital worker movements in the country. And it's still very much alive and kicking, and I think that's what we're seeing now. We're seeing some of the old spirit. We see more workers. There's a whole It's not even the next generation. It's more than one generation. And I think they're organizing again, and the workers are there. It's very clear. So I think we're just seeing more of what was always there.
Do you miss Caesar?
Do I miss Caesar? Oh, do I miss Caesar? Yeah. You know, Caesar was a really good friend as well. He was a co-worker. He was my patient. I was his doctor. But he was also my friend. And it's an enormous loss. I mean, I'll just... he was like a member of my family. And yes, I miss him.
And what do you miss most?
Well, that's like saying, what do you miss about your friend? It's the friendship part of it. Having somebody to talk to, but the beauty of it is, and the great thing about working with Caesar, you can't separate out being a friend and working with Caesar. I mean, they go together. But I guess the biggest thing I miss is getting a good idea about something or wondering about how to approach a certain problem and us talking about it and working on it together and solving it. That's probably what I miss more than anything else. And I still say every once in a while, I forget that he's gone. It's like, you know, my mother just died too, and I still think I'm going to call my mother. That, oh, I want to talk to Caesar about this. But that's what I miss. That's what I miss.
You were also very close and continue to be close to the family.
Yes.
Tell me your impressions of Helen. I mean, she...
Oh, Helen? Oh, Helen's a very, very dear lady. You know, the great thing about Helen is Helen's the same now as she was, you know, when I met her. What? It's been 35 years ago. She's a very strong person. I mean, she and Caesar really used to go at it. I'm sure you're... I mean, she was... he was an Aries and she was an Aquarian, if you believe in that sort of thing, which I don't. But they always said Aries and Aquarians get along if they can figure out which one is boss. And the beauty of the thing, that the relationship, it was always a very, very... That I saw, as I saw it, the relationship. She was very strong. So was Caesar. Caesar could be very controlling, and Caesar could be pretty obnoxious sometimes, you know. But I'm the same way. I mean, he liked people to kind of take him on in a way, but there were limits to that too. But what do I think about Helen? Well, I think that the reason the children are as wonderful as they are, and they are, is because of Helen. Now they love their father, but he wasn't there that much. And Caesar does really make a good argument for what's called quality time, you know, when he was with his children. And they all knew he loved him. And, you know, they have 26, it might be 27 grandchildren now and a great-grandchild. But I'm one of 8 children as well. And Caesar and Helen had 8 children. So I felt very much at home with the family. I also was raised Catholic, and they were a very devout Catholic family. So we shared many values. And I always felt very comfortable with them. And the way it started off was basically the year I got closest to the family was the year that Caesar was sick. I took care of him when he was mostly homebound in bed for a year. And basically worked with Helen and the family. And we just all got along. I mean, it's hard to explain. It's family. How do you explain family? I mean, that's really what it was. We were very close. I probably didn't do that very well, but...
Well, no, you know, what's interesting is...
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 149, and that was take 3.
Okay.
You knew about the room tone and everything.
Oh, yeah. The background noise that's still in.
Okay, that's the end of sound roll number 70.
I really
and the end of the interview with Marian Moses. Goodbye.
Oh, don't tell me.
Okay, this is sound roll 71 for Fight in the Fields of Paradigm Production, minus 8 dB referenced on the following the module limit, which equals 0 VU.
I learned that later.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, this is continuing to be sound roll 71. Our next take, camera roll is camera roll 150, 150. This is going to be the interview with Juanita Brown. We'll be starting with take number 1.
Okay, this will be take 1, Juanita Brown, marker.
Well, Juanita, we were actually just talking about the 60s and how people look back at that period. And we'll talk a lot about the idealists of the 60s. would you look back and call yourself one of those 60s idealists?
Well, I guess I'm reminded actually of a story when you say that, in terms of Gandhi, who was asked one time, did he attribute his success to being a visionary? And he got very irritated, and he said, I am not a visionary. He said, I am a practical idealist. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's how I think of myself, both then and today. You know, I just feel like that was a period in which an awakening began, a questioning about...
Okay, stop. He is unhappy. We were just getting onto something really good.
Rick, you started with the cutting.
No. Okay.
Okay, that was take one. Take two is next. There was an airplane there, sorry.
Let's not... The Gandhi story part was fine, but then let's go on to how you feel about the 60s.
This is take two, marker.
So when you look back at the 60s, what was that blend of practicalism and idealism for you?
Well, you know, I think the 60s was a time where there was a really big awakening, where people were starting to ask very fundamental questions about equity, about justice. There are questions, of course, that were in all of history, but in our country they were being raised in a special kind of way. And I think, in a sense, the real legacy of the 60s will be seen in the 90s. I think it's taken the last 30 years, actually, for the ideals and the values that were born on a mass scale in the 60s among those of us who participated in those activities to actually mature and flower into their adulthood, as we all have.
Well, but let's stay back in the 60s as opposed to the 90s. What was it that drew you to what you heard or learned about the farm workers? What was that attraction?
Well, I was, let me think about that for a moment. What drew me to the farm workers really was that at the time, my husband and myself were on our way to Bolivia to do graduate work in the tin mines with the Bolivian tin miners. My husband was an anthropologist. And we actually went to the farm workers because a colleague of ours, her father was education director of the AFL-CIO. And she came to visit us at Thanksgiving and she said, why are you going to Bolivia? Don't you know the farm workers are having an effort for better life and better wages in California? Both of you are fluent in Spanish. Go to California.
And you came to California, and I presume you went to Delano, and what did you see? Do you remember your first impressions? What struck you the most?
Well, actually, it was the summer of 1966 when we went to Delano, so it was right after the early period that the farm workers began the strike there. And we saw, we saw energy. I guess that was what I could say I saw first. In the Pink House in Delano, which was the farm worker headquarters, people were streaming in and out, Anglo volunteers, farm workers, farm worker family members, and everybody was there to contribute. And I guess the thing that impressed me most about what I saw was the kind of vitality and hope and spirit that was alive in that place and in that orientation to the work. And I was very impressed with that, very moved by it.
Well, I had a question for you in the context of the boycott, but it works just as well in Delano. These were really people from different worlds meeting each other. What was that experience like when middle-class Anglos meet working-class Mexicans?
I actually think that was a very learning-filled...
You can't say that.
Huh?
When you answer, you say, I think the experience of people coming together,
okay.
So we have a context.
Okay. I think the experience of people of different cultural backgrounds coming together in the service of something that they believed in common was a very powerful bridge for people being in a conversation that they had never been in before. A multicultural conversation, a conversation about our common future, the dialogues that happened at the house meetings between the Anglo volunteers and the farm workers, for example. And then the processing after the meetings about what had happened in those house meetings as we sat with Fred Ross on those tattered couches in the Pink House, I think were an opportunity for people to look deeply at their own cultural values. And I think that encounter between Mexican-American culture, Anglo-American culture, the religious orientation of the farm workers and how it was manifested. I think that was a very powerful learning experience for all of us who participated in that.
You make it sound positive, but sometimes, or frequently, when cultures clash, there's tension, there's misunderstanding. Was it difficult?
There were times I think it was difficult. Because I was bicultural myself and had lived in Mexico and lived in the States, did not experience personally that level of what I would call dissonance that many experienced. I think that the whole Latin Anglo cultural thing was difficult for many of the Anglo volunteers. I think the question of male-female relationships and the difference in family norms, you know, were issues. I think the class question, so we were not only talking about cultural questions between ethnicities, the Filipinos, the Mexicans, and the Anglos, but also the class differences between the volunteers who came and the farm workers. So the kind of largesse or paternalistic helping style that many of the Anglos came with in those days, I think was very irritating to many of the Mexicans, the Latinos who were there. And I think there was a learning both ways about that, you know, about what's the essence of goodwill, even though it may be manifested in culturally inappropriate ways or ways that might be seen as culturally inappropriate. And I think that's what shone through in the end. Mm-hmm. You know, was the goodwill and the fact that people were working towards something they believed in common. And that tended to allow people to struggle through the differences in ways that, you know, were more productive than might occur under other circumstances.
Let's talk a little bit about the boycott in general. What do you think, when we talk about the process, it was very complicated, but what do you think it was about the boycott that in the end made it work? What was the glue that held the boycott together and that convinced Americans?
Oh, I think there were multiple threads of that. I mean, I really think of the boycott as a tapestry, in a way. It was a tapestry that connected a larger social good that Americans who have a sense of fairness, basically, were able, in a large scale, to get a sense of, so that when you saw pictures on TV of migrant children, we don't feel proud of that as Americans, even though we know it exists. And so to do a small thing that could help a large number of people make a difference in their lives, I think was one thread. You know, there is a value in America around equity and justice. Whether we practice it fully or not, there is that in the social conscience of Americans. I think also the fact of relationships, that I think the boycott worldwide was built on personal relationships. It was not only built on abstract ideals. And Caesar used to tell us that. People do not join a cause only for an ideal. They join a cause because there is a human relationship that's involved. And I think that the farm workers were, and the volunteers, and then all of the ripples outward, were built on that web of mutuality and personal relationships. House meeting by house meeting, church meeting by church meeting, with businesses, etc., that then expanded outward on a very large scale. I think that's the essence of large-scale change in any kind of setting.
Did you think when the national boycott first started, did it seem an impossible goal, or did you think, oh, sure, we'll just work hard and it'll happen, or how did you look at it from that end?
Well, I mean, at the time, I would say we had kind of a Don Quixote, you know, attitude toward it. I still have, actually.
What does that mean, though?
Well, I would say, I want to reflect on one dimension of that prior to answering that question, is that I to this day have in my office a small, like a statuette that you wind up and it has to dream the impossible dream. And I think that in that way, there was something about realizing that it was an impossible dream and choosing to act as if it could be done. And I think that the farm workers saying as their primary almost theme song, "Sí se puede," yes, it can be done, you know, helped to create a rhythm of hope, even in the face of apparently impossible odds. You know, and so I don't think it was a quixotic impulse, but it was a joining impulse in the face of a very difficult set of circumstances.
What are we doing this, Matt? 40 feet. Let's stop for a second. This is going great. These are wonderful answers. You want a sip of water?
Yeah.
That's your reward. This is the kind of stuff I was hoping would come up. I mean, you never know. It's like...
Okay, that was take number two, and I think that's going to be the end of the camera roll. We'll see. Anyway, that's take two. Before we start up again, we'll talk about all this creativity. Okay, actually we're continuing on camera roll 150, so our next take will be take three.
Okay.
This is take three, marker.
Okay, Juanita, you were going to tell me one of your vividest memories of the boy.
Well, I would say there are two stories. One which was prior to my time in Canada, but happened with Marshall Gans, who was previous to me there. And this relates to what I thought was one of the most creative activities that I had ever imagined seeing.
What did they do?
Or imagining happening on the boycott. The growers kept shipping. The supermarkets would not take off the grapes, and it seemed like a totally intractable situation. And evidently, what occurred there was that on the first week of this particular creative action, there were carloads or van loads of people who went into the stores with balloons, which of course said, don't buy grapes, and they went into the stores and let the balloons up so that they were at the top.
Okay, we're going to change, and then we'll start the story over again.
Okay, that's the end of camera 150. 151's next. Our next take will be take four.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Wonderful. That if we would be staying outside of the bus, you know, in someone's home or whatever, he had brought with him a whole suitcase full of books about Gandhi. But he was too tired to read because he read slowly. And at night, I would read to him from these books of Gandhi. And it was a time of real conversation, both between us and in terms of my own learning about what was the spiritual base of Caesar's activism. And I think that's something that has been a bridge between the work of Caesar in the 60s and the potential for a transformative change at this time in our history, is that even then I think his political work was sourced from a deep spiritual foundation. And those weeks on the road helped me to really anchor in that part of myself, as well as in the conversations with him about the ideas that were in that work.
And of course, the issue of him going to the boycott cities, when he would come to a city, it would give a certain energy that, you know, really something would happen. Wouldn't it?
Well, of course, it would begin to mobilize and bring coherence to a multiple sectors coming together on behalf of this work.
Well, I'm specifically talking on a personal level about Caesar's personality and how it really affected people, and how people responded to who he was.
Yeah, I think people often talk about Caesar as a charismatic leader, but I didn't think about Caesar in that way. I thought about Caesar as what I would call an integral leader or a holistic leader, in the sense that his style evoked the decency in other people. It was not about what he said or even how he said it. It was more about who he was in his presence with people that I think evoked that kind of energy.
But do you think that was calculated, or was that just his natural affect?
Well, you know, you can never tell about the deep inner world of another person. It felt to me like he was a very deeply committed person. And in that sense, deeply committed people, and all people, have a whole range that they draw from in their work. So.
Now, I want to go back to where we started, the 60s idealism. Do you think what happened then could only have happened because of the 60s, and is it really an artifact of the 60s, or is there something there that people can build on and do something with that?
Oh, I don't think it was an artifact of the 60s. I think its particular form and style might have been an artifact of that historical moment. But the impulse that bred the 60s, I think, is still very much alive and well in the environmental movement, in local initiatives that are taking place more and more as our institutions begin to demonstrate that they are not as adept as people had hoped they would be, not just the economic institutions, but our political institutions and even the social service institutions, our education, where people are beginning to organize at the local level, not against, but now they're organizing for in a certain way. And I think that the evolution of our awareness of the environment and of what provides fundamental nourishment for life in a certain way really connects not just the 60s, but the essence of the farm workers movement and what it was about in terms of the fundamentals of what provides nourishment for life, food for life, is actually coming into this period in our history as well, but in a deepened form, in a way. It may be a quieter form, not as raucous a form as it was then, but I think it is just as deep and will become as these next period, as the millennium approaches, as some would say, a very profound and deep reorientation of how we all live our lives. And I think we began that in the 60s.
How much do we have up to this?
Okay, that was take four. The head slate, take five's next.
Yeah.
Okay, this is take five. Marker?
Okay. Juanita, tell me this idea about the boycott.
Well, you know, oftentimes people said that the farm workers movement and that the boycott in particular was part of the some kind of a protest or the radical movements of the 60s, but I never really saw it like that. I actually saw that the boycott was the exercise of people's democratic right not to buy, just like people have a democratic right to buy. And I felt that this was really work on behalf of the fundamental democratic principles upon which this country was born. So it seemed to me that what I was really doing was returning to our roots. If you think that radical, the word radical means returning to the roots, then that is what I felt my work was in the farm workers, was actually learning how to become an American, a true American in the sense of the ideals on which this country was founded. And that the boycott and the opportunity for people to exercise that democratic right was fundamental to our American way of life.
Well, of course, when you were out there now, and I'll remind you, what the growers always said was, we're being blackmailed, the workers don't want us, you're forcing us to sign contracts. How did you answer them then?
Well, they were not watching the workers in the fields. They were not in the house meetings where people were together really looking at, in real dialogue, about what they wanted for themselves and their children as their common future. And I think that, had they been able to enter as human beings into that quality of conversation, they would have seen that the workers were no different than them in a certain way. And that just like they wanted a decent future for themselves and their families and their children, their workers were seeking the same fundamental, basic American life that they enjoyed as well. So I don't really think of this as blackmail in any way, but really as an invitation to the growers to join in the common community of what a decent life is for all of us.
They sort of declined. Now the other...
they did decline.
I have one more thought. I don't want to reload unless you have some thoughts on it. There were two different whole modes of boy.
Okay, that was the end of camera roll 151. And that was take five. It didn't work. No contracts can make your words totally distorted. Okay, this is going to be room tone for the interview with Juanita Brown.
You said
that's the kind of thoughtful, reflective. Okay, that's the
what this film is about is
end of Room Tone for the interview with Juanita Brown, and that's the end of the sound roll and the end of the interview. Goodbye.
So this is the what it meant.
That story about reading to scissors.
Yeah.